The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia, New Jersey. Dr. Joe Fallon here, going to have a Joe Fallon Endocrine Week summary for today's visit with Philadelphia and New Jersey. To start off with a quote, Angela Merkel, politician from Germany, "The question is not whether we are able to change, but whether we are changing fast enough." And on this program, you're going to see the change that's happening in medicine. I do want to point out that next week we will have Bob Marrow on. Dr. Marrow is an internist with lots of experience practicing in Cherry Hill and the virtual health system. He'll be on next week, and I can't wait to hear Bob's comments. Just to be a little national to start off, U.S. employers added 528,000 jobs in July. Recovering the jobs lost at the beginning of the pandemic is operative. Average hourly earnings grew 5.2% from a year ago, while unemployment returned to pre-pandemic levels at 3.5%, a half a century low. Progress is being made. As seen just prior to the pandemic, that was our number. The kickback is that 623 fewer people were in the workforce, a factor that has pushed wages up to demand. Low jobless rate means increased wages. If you need a denario, it's time to get a job now. Good news. U.S. hospitalization data indicates the latest COVID-19 surge is starting to cool. We know that the variants have been a little bit more infective, but not as grueling on our health, but still too many. Remember, more Americans are on the job now than any time since the pandemic began. In summary, new jobs versus new jobless claims was a blowout, 528,000 new jobs versus loss of 260,000. Positive progress. What caught my eye this week was in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology Metabolism statement. Their mission statement of the Endocrine Society is, "We unite, lead, and grow the endocrine community to accelerate scientific breakthroughs and improve health worldwide." This is absolutely 100% true. And as we're going to discuss some of the medical issues upcoming, you'll see this is definitely true. Bariatric surgery is the most effective currently available treatment for obesity. Patients typically lose 20 to 35% of their body weight after surgery, which is often sustained for many years. The idea that we can have such great results, 30,000 adults had surgery, 46 years average age, 77% women, who 5,053 had a BMI of 35 kilograms per meter squared or greater and underwent bariatric surgery between 2004 and 2017. These patients were matched against 25,265 patients with obesity who did not undergo bariatric surgery. The mean difference between in body weight at 10 years was 24.8 kilograms for a 19.2% greater weight loss among patients who had bariatric surgery than those who just traveled along. Remember, you have to multiply 24.8 by 2.2 to get the actual weight loss. Most patients on bariatric surgery, in my experience, lose 35% of their body mass. So the bottom line is the substantial weight loss was required to observe a meaningful reduction in cancer risk in a dose-dependent manner. Currently, bariatric surgery is the only available treatment that can provide the magnitude and durability of weight loss for decreasing cancer-related mortality, for decreasing incidence of diabetes, and for generating significant help in terms of blood pressure, et cetera. So again, in summary, the bariatric surgery group lost almost 25 kilos, remember, 25 times 2.2 or more weight than the non-surgical group, had a 32% decrease in risk for developing one of the 13 obesity-associated cancers, and had a 17% reduced risk of developing any cancer in toto. So bariatric surgery definitely has been a major positive for the health of the country. The issue coming up, though, is that we now have GLP drugs, two on the market. One is approved for weight loss, and that is Wegovy, and the other probably will get approval soon, Terapeptide. These medications generate 17 to 22% weight loss, with a number of patients doing better. So will bariatric surgeons in the future have a challenge from the pharmacology side? My impression is I can't wait to see how this pans out, because weight loss in those who are significantly overweight definitely pays dividends. What I like, too, is that I also lose patients, because once you get that bariatric surgery, once you get that weight loss, diabetes seems to go away, which I'm very happy for. Let's move on to other issues we talked about that the Endocrinology Journal talked about. How about that there's an estimated 37 million adults in the U.S. have chronic kidney disease, and up to 90% don't know they have it. Despite managing risk factors and treatment with ACEs and ARBs, patients with chronic kidney disease may still have a substantial risk of worsening kidney function. Now, this is very important, because what we're seeing is a massive improvement in kidney function, tremendous save in people who would normally go to dialysis who won't. And I can tell you this, using the four type of medicines that are now available for doctors, I've seen a significant reversal in my patient's renal status, lose a little bit, but guess what? Stuff's getting better. Now, kidney disease has five stages. Stage one means that your kidneys are great. Stage two says you got overall good kidneys. That means that you're clearing waste products out of your blood at 60 to 89 cc's per minute. The math isn't important, but basically, once you get down to what they call a stage three, remember there's five, the last one is going to be end-stage renal disease with dialysis or a kidney transplant. The kidney transplant certainly is better, but certainly is challenging. In stage 3A, the cardiovascular risk is more than double greater than those who don't have kidney disease. So again, problem is, as we lose kidney function, there seems to be a cardiovascular challenge to the heart with greater CV death risk moving up twofold. When you get down to 30 to 44 cc's per minute, so again, we're starting out at 100, that's called 3B, and the cardiovascular death rate goes to four times greater. So again, the best thing to do is to make sure that you go to your family doctor, make sure he checks your kidney function through the blood, and also frequently will ask you to give a kidney sample. And the issue is that how much protein are you leaking out? So there is a protein called albumin, and I remember that from my internist days when I was in the hospital, and we would have people with massive edema, because once your albumin drops, you tend to hold a lot of fluid. And I would like to give some people with shortness of breath an extra fluid, a bolus of albumin. But the cost was limiting, and the pharmacist would say, Fallon, not yet. They got to have it get a little bit worse. So again, the best thing to do is to make sure that you don't lose your own albumin through the kidney. And it's more or less like a sieve. So as the sieve opens up, as the renal insufficiency gets worse, as the creatinine clearance gets worse, we see more protein leak out. If you're less than a 30, you got fantastic kidneys and you're in great shape. If you're 31 to 300, you better hustle. And if you're over 300, you have definitive renal damage. So again, giving a urine sample is very important to make sure that your kidney status can be more or less blocked for degradation. So there is a stage 4, that's 15 to 29 cc's per minute. And then there was a stage 5, less than 15 cc's per minute. At that point, again, people need dialysis or kidney transplant. The question is there medications now that can save renally? Like I just talked about the two GLP drugs that can actually significantly reverse diabetes through weight loss. Now we have four drug categories that can help save renal tissue. Now, believe me, this is very important because I cannot believe, because I've been practicing quite a few years in endocrinology, how we can reverse kidney damage in our diabetics. Absolutely stunning. Now, that started about 20 years ago when ACE inhibitors came out. And the ACE inhibitor actually that I put myself on is Ramipril, which has been around 20 years plus. Now, ACE inhibitors have one side effect. You can cough, but if you don't cough, and if you do cough, you won't stop coughing. You'll know it's time to talk to your doctor and hop off of an ACE inhibitor. But lisinopril, ramipril, these are phenomenal drugs. And since 20 years, they've been reducing renal insufficiency. So ACE inhibitors were big, are big, and are very inexpensive and worthwhile using if your doctor tells you that you are leaking some albumin through your kidney. A little bit ain't no good, and a lot is definitely a problem. So again, ACE inhibitors are fantastic. I can say this, that if you look up the history of Ramipril, years ago, a patient in my pharmacy class sat in the back, and he and his brothers actually put a bid in for Ramipril that was with the results to be in the New England Journal of Medicine the next day. They bid for the drug. Basically, Ramipril came in and showed that it decreased heart failure, it decreased kidney loss, and they became very successful pharmacists. They initially were very preemptive in that they provided outpatient IV antibiotic therapy for the people in the Washington, D.C. area. So they basically deserve to get a fantastic plus for the brass they had to buy Ramipril before the New England Journal of Medicine article. Then came along ARBs. Now, ARBs are a different class of drug. They don't have a cough, but again, they showed that they worked a little bit further down the path from where ACEs worked in preventing kidney and heart failure. Common names for they are Diovan and Avapro. Please note that these drugs are now generic. So again, for 20 years, we've had Avapro, Diovan, and other ARBs and ACEs that can prevent diabetic kidney loss. So if you have that albumin, the doctor asks you for it, pee in that cup and make sure that if you're over 30 that you get yourself one of these drugs. But guess what? Time has moved on and pharmacology has moved upward. And now their medication is called SGLT2 drugs. These drugs have been phenomenal. I'm so happy to say that we have people on multiple drugs now to prevent further kidney loss and actually to reverse kidney loss. But SGLT2 drugs by name, Invokana, Farxiga, Steglatro, Jardiance, these four characters are phenomenal. In my hands, I've seen such kidney preservation, such reversal of kidney disease, that I'm incredibly happy to have them available. I do note that these SGLT2 drugs that I just named not only preserve kidney function and improve kidney function if there's a loss, they also prevent heart disease. Congestive heart failure is significantly decreased. Symptoms of congestive heart failure are significantly positive. So do I love SGLT2s? Yes. The biggest problem is making sure that an insurer will pay for that for you or your patient. Sometimes you have to hoop through 1, 2, 3, 4, but basically the patient benefits. Now, the thing about the SGLT2 drugs, they already said they preserve kidney function, improve kidney function. They also are very beneficial for heart failure. So you're going to see a patient sometimes come in, and if you have renal insufficiency and we see an elevation, we put you on a statin drug. If your LDL cholesterol, say it's the average person 135 and we drop you down to 74, you get a 40-some percent reduction in MI, stroke, and death. Not bad for probably something that's 15 cents a day. The ones that we usually hear about, Lipitor, generic atorvastatin, and Crestor, Rubistatin, incredibly good drugs. Now, additionally, you'll find people with heart issues also on beta blockers. They make things better. They're also put on ACEs and ARBs because they also decrease heart failure. So we have a fourth drug category I'm going to talk about in a minute. But I first want to say that there is a reduction in significantly cardiovascular death with SGLT2 drugs, 39% drop if your A1C gets less than 7, and 28% body weight drop, 2.8% body weight drop for those with type 2. So your SGLT2 drugs decrease weight, decrease heart failure, improve kidney function, definitely a win, and also lower blood sugar. The bottom line is that there is a side effect to this, that one of the things that they do is they increase glucose loss in the urine, so that can predispose to vaginitis for gals, penile irritation for guys, but the benefit is outstanding, and I'm so happy to have these drugs in my armamentarium. I just wish I could get it approved a little easier, as the hoops the doctors have to go through are a little bit tough. Finally, we have another medication that's hit the road and is running fast, and that's finerone, trade name Kerendia. This particular medication is used once a day. It also has fantastic improvement in kidney function, and we also combine these frequently with the other three drug classes I recommended. So, again, remember that type 2 diabetes is the number one cause of kidney failure. It's three times more likely to die of heart disease. We have four drug classes that can help you. So if you're a diabetic, make sure you discuss with your family doctor what is available for you to make sure, number one, do you not have any loss of albumin, which indicates a progressive loss of renal function. Is your level less than 30? Pat yourself on the back. Is it 30 to 300? Got to get ready to do something quick. And over 300, you're definitely doing things. Remember, Finerone, the new medication that's a mineralocorticoid blocker, the fourth class, decreases the loss of GFR, that's your kidney function, decreases your chance of moving forward to end-stage kidney disease, has a decrease in cardiovascular death, forget the stroke, forget the MI, has a decrease in non-fatal MI, and a decreased hospitalization for heart failure. So your doc will have to monitor potassium, blood pressure, electrolytes, and, of course, is things getting better? Moving forward, we have a very interesting publication from the Endocrine Society on page 909, New Horizons, Next Generation Insulin Analogs, Structural Principles and Clinical Goals. Sounds tough, but basically, insulin is getting better and better, and they're calling it smart insulin. We have to go back. We know now that insulin has been on the market for 100 years. We had a previous show where one of our endocrinologists from Philadelphia talked about insulin, but we have to remember that basically, is insulin getting better? The answer is yes. We call it there's first-generation insulin, second-generation insulins, and we're having other insulins that can penetrate the brain better, other insulins that do all sorts of amazing things. We've always tried to find ways to get insulin in quicker, because if you're somebody who inadvertently developed a blood sugar of 400, we would tell people to give a deep injection, the best they can do, in their leg, because once you get to 400, you're dehydrated. People would be taking heating pads out and putting it on top to try and increase the absorption quickly so that they can reverse that significant blood sugar elevation to hopefully avoid maybe a trip to the ER and maybe a hospitalization. Pharmaceutical companies had put different types of materials in to try and increase the absorption of the insulin, which has been done now because now we have some super insulins, Fiasp, Lumjev, which actually hop in the circulation within 2 hours. We get significant impact. Well, that's their duration, but they work very, very quick. Additionally, people have come up with injections with needle-free injections, which can get into the tissues deeper. And we also have had inhaled insulin, which was an incredibly effective agent. It basically was in the bloodstream in a minute. People would inhale it and would get significant reductions in sugars quickly. Regretfully, inhaled insulin has not really taken off, despite the fact that there was great intentions. If you go back and remember, the insulins we have right now are usually Aspartin and Lispro. There's the approval of the ultra-rapid insulins. We overall have had much faster absorption of insulins, much better control, and we have to say that diabetes is getting better. The thing is that there is now significant progress also moving forward. because basically one of the issues is how to beat hypoglycemia and weight gain with insulin. Various insulins are now being approved that more or less will try and overcome that. We're seeing pharma basically utilizing combinations, like they'll use amylin, which is an injection that was pushed by one individual because of his daughter was diabetic. Never really caught on well, but amylin has the ability to make people not eat. It's called pramlintide, P-R-A-M-L-I-N-T-I-D-E. It was on the market. We had patients lose a lot of weight. It was short-acting and just really never caught on. But we're now going to see probably in the future pramlintide added to insulin to try and make it faster, which will also increase satiety. It also slows gastric emptying, so if you want to eat a lot, it says no. And it also inhibits glucagon, which tends to raise your insulin. So we have fantastic insulin-amylin combinations probably going to come. We do want to point out, if you're diabetic, that the liver is a very important organ because the liver basically gets rid of, stores 22 hours worth of sugar. So if somebody gets hypoglycemic, we rely on our liver to supply us with insulin because basically you can't tell your brain you're not going to get anything to eat. It needs it every second, and so do your kidneys, et cetera. So if you have, if you take sub-Q insulin, regretfully, that bypasses your liver, and when it bypasses the insulin with that shot, the liver does not get insulinized, which is a deficit. So it overall decreases the efficiency of the body. We want our liver to have significant insulin because that stops the insulin from leaking out. So the diabetic who misses his shot at night, who is insulin requiring, he'll see the liver will jump up, will kick out all the sugar overnight. They wake up, they're very high, and then they say, oh, my God, I forgot my shot. So that nighttime shot or that basal insulin is very important. Additionally, there is many things that some people call it type 4 diabetes. That's an insufficient amount of insulin that gets to the brain. Some people say that this has something to do with Alzheimer's. That's basically being talked about but not proven yet. But overall, they're looking for insulins that can penetrate the blood-brain barrier a bit better so that the average diabetic will have that penetration. But with exogenous insulin, the answer so far is no. Additionally, insulin tends to put weight on people. That's why a lot of the people just come in and say, I don't want insulin. My friend got insulin and gained 20 pounds. Of course, you know, if you can, you have to retitrate the calories and retitrate the insulin. And if you do that, people don't gain as much weight. And we anticipate that the newer analogs coming out are going to be fantastic. So we basically have to make sure that we can get insulin to nations and people who live in countries that don't have adequate refrigeration. We have to basically get insulins that are improved, that can insulinize the liver, that can penetrate the brain, and that basically decrease hypoglycemia. So what we're seeing here is that the pharmacy companies are definitely advancing insulin. We anticipate significant improvement long term. I just want to review with everybody that we have, going back, we have metformin, which is a drug that should be taken twice a day. I will tell you this, that the regular metformin acts better on sugar than the sustained action metformin. Metformin should be taken twice a day, does a great job, does seem to have a significant benefit mind-wise and health-wise. Then came along the DPP-4 inhibitors, not as strong as we would like. Januvia is one of them, but high safety, and it basically decreases the metabolism of GLP-1s, which make it last longer and allow patients to benefit. Patients with mild diabetes benefit substantially from this product. It's still expensive. For diabetes, we also have sulfonylureas. Glimepiride is the number one sold drug. The main reason is that glimepiride can be metabolized through your liver and your kidney. So that therefore you don't have, if you have any kind of kidney dysfunction or if you have hepatic dysfunction, you've got a dual way of getting rid of that medication, and the medication kind of goes to the pancreas and say, hey, look, it kicks it and says, get some more out. We have the SGLP-2 drugs. They're the ones I just talked about with the kidney improvement, heart failure improvement, weight loss improvement, sugar improvement. Those four drugs are phenomenal. Recommend them highly. You only need one at a time. Don't vote for two at a time. You have the GLP-1 drugs, which we talked about. They're making phenomenal benefit, making people lose weight. Remember that those drugs go to your hypothalamus and say, hey, you don't have to eat. Works very well. We're seeing weight loss drugs with about, like I said, 17 to 22% reduction in body weight, which is substantially positive. We do note that they're usually once a week now. We have once a day. We have once a week. They can do a phenomenal job. And again, they have less heart attacks. They decrease strokes. So basically, GLP-1 drugs are here to stay. We just hope the prices don't go up. We hope that insurance coverage is good. We have the newer ultra-rapid acting insulins that work very quick. So if you've got that high sugar, somehow you missed a shot or ate the wrong stuff, your Lyumjev or Fiasp can be addressed now. Additionally, you have the inhaled insulin. Regretfully hasn't picked up as much as we'd like. And finally, we have basal insulins that last for a few days, like 3 days, because basically, generally, every diabetic has a usual 50% of their insulin is basal. That means it just goes around the bloodstream, making sure that the sugar doesn't leak out of the liver so that you have these high numbers that when you wake up in the morning. And it basically keeps that sugar in the cells so that the patient has a much more efficient machine. We want to also say that, like I just said, there's going to be significant improvements in insulin delivery. Moving on. We're going to talk about surgery. So one of the biggest problems we have in endocrinology is there's a disease called hyperparathyroidism. And hyperparathyroidism has really improved dramatically since I got into business. And generally, your parathyroid tissue starts in utero at the back of the throat, and it rotates down and ends up hiding four little glands hide behind your thyroid gland. Now, sometimes there's a mistake, and it rotates all the way down into the chest. That would prove to be a very challenging problem because surgeons would go in trying to find out the culprit, and there was no gland there that was abnormal. They would close up, and the patient would still not be cured of his hypercalcemia because the parathyroid glands go and chisel out calcium out of your bones. And when your calcium goes up, you start peeing because the body tries to get rid of it by peeing. So who wants to stay up at night because of their parathyroid problem? Now, remember I said to you that there's four glands, so the surgeons always want to know how many glands are bad. So a lot of times they'll do an ultrasound or a CAT scan or a parathyroid scan looking to see who the culprit gland is because usually the culprit gland is one. One goes bad, so what they do is they take that out, close up, and you're done. And a lot of times that can take 30 minutes. Of course, they tell me, Dr. Fallon, don't tell us how long to operate. This is a tedious deal, and we want you to just basically tell the patient we'll take care of it. Now, the problem is that sometimes they get two bad glands, and you really need an astute surgeon who's very comfortable in the neck to try and discern which gland is there. Is it the number one? And if what they do is they do a blood test in the OR, it takes a few minutes to come back, and if it tells them the calcium is still high, they have to go on and look for another adenoma. So the problem is that you can have a single adenoma, you can have two adenomas, and sometimes there's something called hyperplasia where the poor surgeon has to deal with all four glands because they're all a little bit puffy. Now, of course, if you're the one getting operated, the longer it takes to get four glands out means that you're going to be under the knife a little bit longer. But quality surgeons get things done. Remember that when you have parathyroid surgery, the New England Journal of Medicine said a few years ago that if you have parathyroid surgery, you should have it done at a center that has intraoperative PTH and, of course, surgeons that are in the neck all the time. So again, hyperparathyroidism, things are getting better, but we still need to move forward a little bit more. So you can have one gland out of four go bad. You can have two glands out of four go bad. You can have all glands go bad, and you can also have sometimes a fifth gland hiding in the chest. So parathyroid surgery in the Philadelphia marketplace has improved dramatically. We have excellent surgeons and generally excellent results. Happy to say, since I've been in the business, we've gotten significant improvement in parathyroid function. So just want to move on to a great discussion in the office this week because it seems like all of a sudden constipation was everywhere. And I am not a specialist in GI, but generally if you don't have a bowel movement in a week, that's considered constipation. Some people are worse. So we had a few patients with constipation this week. I don't know what happened. But people ask me, well, how about Senecot? Because basically Senecot is a gut irritant. That irritates the gut, increases the motility, and pushes the stool out, and people are happy. The only problem is that a lot of people, once they try Senecot, they keep on taking it. So I'm not against it, but you got to remember that you can't rely on Senecot every day, or otherwise, years later, you will not go to the bathroom without Senecot doubling or tripling. So Senecot is a gut irritant, and you don't want to rely on that, but you certainly can. The other issue that always comes up is, well, doctor, can I use citrate of magnesia? So classically, I remember citrate of magnesia from my father's delicatessen. My father always put 3 bottles of citrate in the refrigerator, and people would come into the store late at night and say, look, I'm constipated. What can you do for me? And my father would tell him, you have a chilled bottle of citrate. Go home, sit close. You'll go quick. So citrate of magnesia is fantastic for somebody who needs to be unplugged quickly, drink the whole bottle down, and sit by the toilet. But things have gotten better over time. So now for constipation, we have medications like Miralax. So Miralax is the last new constipation drug on the market. It's over the counter. It works by 3 mechanisms. Number one, it tries to put water into stool. Number two, it tries to add a little bulk, I think, by psyllium. And number three, it has a little bit of a propulsive effect. So they had 3. Miralax is great. The problem is sometimes it's just not potent enough. And especially if somebody is on a narcotic, because we know that there's these little, what they call mu receptors. I always love that name, mu, opioid receptors, that seem to get stuck, which makes constipation tougher and tougher. So opioid use with constipation, you want to discuss it with your GI guy or doctor, what's the right thing to do. But if somebody doesn't have a bowel movement once a week, if somebody has bloating in the stomach, somebody has to be pushing harder, if patients have dry, hard stools, and incomplete emptying, that's constipation suprema. So I will say that just because this is not an endocrinologist deal, but we came up from somehow this week a lot, increase your fluids, eat more high-fiber food. Remember, high-fiber food, there's 2 types, water-soluble, water-insoluble. The water-soluble fibers are much better. That's why Metamucil sells so much on the market. We also do note that if somebody is on a GLP-1, that the medication usually lasts a week, and if it seems to wear off after a week, somebody can take a Metamucil-type product, because once you the dominant mechanism of action is the GLP-1s work on your hypothalamus area, your brain, but they also work on the gut by slowing gut transit, so it's hard to eat once your stomach says, I'm not letting any food out. So what happens is if you can add in a Metamucil at the 4th, 5th, or 6th, or 7th, 6th day after your GLP-1 injection once a week, you will get an increased power of the GLP-1 by optimizing the gut reduction in speed effect. So again, there are more gastrointestinal guys have and gals have much more potent medication that one can be used. Just from my simplistic way of an endocrinologist for constipation, remember, if the stool is scabalous, that means hard. Get yourself some Colace, increase up your fluid. That would increase the volume of the stool, make it softer. If you're really desperate, you can use a stimulant cathartic such as Ducalax, which can be taken below and above so that you can have a Ducalax suppository or you can have a Ducalax tablet. You have to remember when you're talking about constipation, don't you like an endocrinologist talking about this, that the problem is everything stuck down below or is it stuck on the top? Remember, if you're giving yourself a Fleet's Phosphor Soda and the stuck is up top, it's not going to work. You'd have to use a Ducalax or something like that that is an irritant up top to push it through. Metamucil adds bulk. Metamucil adds softness, increased water in. So the answer is that just you can consult your family doctor who's better at this than me. You can consult a GI guy who's definitely better than me. But constipation is a little bit tough, that's for sure. And it was big this week. I don't know why. Moving on. One of my favorite topics is thyroid dysfunction. Now, thyroid dysfunction is very common. And the problem is that it comes to be very, very important. So if somebody is hypothyroid and pregnant, they need the best numbers you can get. So you do not want to be somebody who forgets their thyroid pills, who doesn't take their thyroid pills religiously if you're pregnant. First of all, getting pregnant requires tip-top thyroid function. The guy upstairs is not dumb, and if you don't take your thyroid medication, if you're not diagnosed with hypothyroidism, he's going to do everything possible, maybe it's a she, to make sure that you don't get pregnant. So again, if you have a thyroid condition in pregnancy, you can get it done beautifully, but you have to be very, very attentive to the disease. The first things is the reproductive endocrinology specialist, I'm a regular endocrinologist, basically stress that if you want to get pregnant, you have to have a TSH less than 2.5. So the usual range of a TSH would be 0.3 would be the third person, say 5.5 would be the 97th person. They say if you're trying to get pregnant, you cannot be above 2.5, or they really don't want to see you. They'll say, go see your family doctor, your endocrinologist, get that TSH lower, because basically they don't want to deal with anybody who's going to be hypothyroid. Remember, there's about, I think, 1 in 250,000 people are born without a thyroid. That's why it's mandated by the states that any baby born has to have a heel stick where they check and make sure they have a thyroid. The world knows about hypothyroidism and births. For instance, in China, every girl at 18 must go in and get a shot of iodine in their rear end. Because in China and areas such as Italy, there's a very low amount of iodine in the soil and in the production of food. And therefore, a baby born with not insufficient iodine basically can become mentally off. And that's why it's urgent to treat kids who have no thyroid with thyroid right away. And that's been handled in the U.S. By good laws and good practice in medicine. So the thing about going back to get pregnant, the reproductive endo doctors, if someone can't get pregnant, it can be as easy as putting somebody on thyroid hormone if and only if their thyroid is low. Now, the issue is that what's the normal thyroid level? So we've had various, when I first started out, the TSH said if you're over 10, you're considered hypothyroid. Well, now the assays have gotten way, way lower. And the endocrinologists are always dealing with different institutions with different normals. We do know the University of Penn endocrinologists got mad that the Penn assay was down to 1.1 as the 97th person. And somehow they revolted, and it's now up to 1.3. But generally, we're going to say they run 0.3 to 5. So again, if you're over that 2.5, the reproductive endos really don't want to see it because they figure if you can just get your thyroid titrated quicker, that the pregnancy will occur. So again, will you get fertile if your TSH is above 2.5? They say generally no. And anyway, you want to make sure that your TSH, I would say, is no higher than a 1.5 in an assay that goes up to 5. Now, what happens with thyroid hormone is that there's many, many players out there. Synthroid was the dominant player in the business. And this past year, our government, Medicare, decided not to pay for Synthroid unless you jump up and down and spend a lot of time on a phone. So what happened is, and of course, the price went way up. So we're having a big conundrum in the United States right now. Are you going to take Synthroid or are you going to take levothyroxine? Now, the problem is, if you allow someone to substitute your drug, say you said Synthroid or Levoxyl or one of the others, and you decide to let them pick anyone they want, the pharmacist is advised, because they're now controlled by big business, you give them the cheapest levothyroxine product you can find. Is it going to be from China? Is it going to be from Denmark? Where the hell is it going to be from? So the problem is poor thyroid drug products are out there. And if you have a drug that's only absorbed by 60%, that means there's lots of room for for failure to titrate somebody appropriately, especially somebody who's pregnant or wants to get pregnant. You do have to remember that coffee will bind your thyroid medication. Therefore, you can't drink your coffee. Get your thyroid in and wait an hour. Food binds thyroid hormone, probably about 40%. That's why the general recommendation is if you're on a thyroid pill to take it 1 hour before breakfast. And again, that timing is important. So there's now four recommendations for when to take your thyroid pill. The first one is 60 minutes before breakfast. The second one is bedtime. The third one is 30 minutes before dinner. And the fourth one is 30 minutes before breakfast. So if you're in the hypothyroid business, make sure that you take your medication appropriately. My wife is a thyroid drinker, so she basically said she's going to take her medication at bedtime, and my impression is she's improved thyroid delivery in many, many patients by notifying everybody. So I notify, she doesn't want me to do that, that she takes her thyroid pill at night. Again, moving forward to this drug. This drug is only absorbed 60% of the time, so that's called a bioavailability drug. And I've seen people try and say that there's no reason that you should just take the cheapest one, the levothyroxine dose. But you take a look at some of the studies. The average person takes between 100 and 125 mics of L-thyroxine a day for success. Yet, if you basically have a generic drug, the variation in absorption can be totally different. So is it a 60% absorption? Is it a 70% absorption? Is it a 25% absorption? And you see studies that come out and say, well, we treated people with levothyroxine at 50 mics. Now, remember that the usual replacement dose is 100 to 125, full replacement dose, and they're giving you a study of 50 mics and saying, yeah, it works. Well, that means those people are barely hypothyroid, and they're trying to say that it works. Boo hiss. So, again, if you want to get pregnant, your TSH has to be less than 2.5, and that depends on your assay. Probably that one's one less than 5. You want to take your pill at least an hour before breakfast or move it to another time that was recommended. Preferably, I'd recommend you stay on the same drug product. Do not let your pharmacist pick the one that his corporate entity says he has to, because they're going to pick the one that's the least expensive and how good is the quality. So I regard this to be the great medical experiment in reproduction, the great medical experiment in perk and pop in our population, by suggesting that people take a generic levothyroxine, which means that you're going to have a different, quote, drug product, most likely every time you show up. Who's going to come in with the lowest price? So, again, batch-to-batch uniformity, timing of the medicine, make sure you take it an hour ahead if you need. If you're going to get pregnant, I would recommend strongly that you do not take a generic levothyroxine. Let your doctor make the decision and not corporate America. Now, we have still some significant time. And another issue that comes up is the famous toenails. So we do see a lot of people in the office, and it's summertime, and a lot of them have their sandals on. And if there's one thing we see is nasty toenails. Now, nasty toenails probably have no real significant health risk, except they don't look nice, and a lot of people just don't like them. So we get hit with, you know, who's causing those toenails? And it's usually a dermatophyte. It can be a yeast. It can be a mold. And it's basically a cosmetic issue. The appearance of the nails just aren't nice. Of course, they can go ingrown into the side of the nail, cause an infection. Additionally, if you have nails that are loaded with fungus or dermatophytes or yeast, they can spill over between the toes. Now, tinea pedis, you know, of the nails and the toes can certainly be a big problem, because basically you see people with cracks in the nails. You don't put Bactroban on that. That's for bacteria. This is usually a fungus or a dermatophyte. So the over-the-counter stuff helps, but it tends not to get rid of it. It gets stuck in those nails. And we've had different medications that have come along that help a lot. I can say they help. Are they always a cure? Does somebody get re-fungicized? The answer is yes. So we have now medications that you can take by mouth. You have medications that you can take topically. Some people have used lasers. I can't say how good it is, but those tungal toenails are usually cosmetic. Yes, you can get a Dremel tool and Dremel them down. Just make sure you don't go too far. The problem is that if you think about how long a nail grows, so a fingernail takes 3 to 6 months to go from the beginning of the nail to the end of the nail. And remember, the nail starts under the cuticle, so it's a little bit deeper. You don't even see where it starts, so it can be fungicized all the way down there. Toenails are 12 to 18 months. Now, they are very tough to treat. There's a number of medications we use. We used to use one medication, griseofulvin, but that was very poorly effective, and that's kind of going out of the way. A lot of people use Lamisil. You can take that drug for 8 weeks for fingernails. If it's toenails, you have to take it for 12 weeks. If you go to some of the specialists in the business, they'll use Sporinox or Itraconazole. Seems to work better. There's a medication, Ketoconazole, which is very strong, and you have to watch out with other medications you're taking. And the future looks like it's going to end up on being lacquers that can penetrate the nail. The problem is the fungus is actually underneath the nail, so it's hard to get the medication or the lacquer to get penetrate through the nail into the bed where the fungus is. That's why you'll see some of the over-the-counters say, you know, if your nail's a little elevated, please squirt my stuff in under the nail. So, again, summertime, there is treatment for it. You have to take it for a while. My impression is that you can make a significant dent. The cure issue is a problem, but make sure you start about 2 to 3 months, if it's a toenail, before next year's summertime. So it is now time to move on a little bit. We want to talk about osteoporosis. So osteoporosis is a common deal in the population. It occurs as we get older. And what happens is that our bone mass decreases. Now, general recommendation is once a gal hits menopause, that they should get a DEXA scan. The purpose of the DEXA scan is to get a baseline. And then what happens is that 2 years later, you'll get a second DEXA scan to see what the rate of your bone loss is. So again, you have to go to the same place. There's about 3 machines on the market. If you go to one machine one time, one machine the other time, the radiologist reading your data point will say, I'm very sorry, but I can't compare and contrast. Because what you really want to know is, what is the rate of your bone loss per year? So if you are losing 1% of your bone mass per year, you're okay. If you're using 1.5% per year, you're okay. But if you're losing 2% per year, maybe you have to think about, what are you going to do to try and block that bone mass? We always see what we call a dowager's hump, or a gal when they get older, they bend over because basically they've lost height in their disc. Remember, your spine has all these discs, and in between they have a little jelly thing that basically makes as a buffer when you're going up and down. Of course, that's a simplistic statement. And of course, we know that once a gel gets compressed and you get bone on bone, the nerve coming out of that spine can be very, very painful, and that does definitely cause problems. So if you get to the pinched nerve, you're going to see a back specialist. We know it's a lot of pain. Everybody says don't go see a back specialist because they're going to want to operate. But there's many, many things that people can be done today to try and assess what happened to their spine and what happened to their pelvis, because the most significant deal is if you lose hip bone, and you get that broken hip, it's significant surgery. You have to get better. You have to get back on your feet, or otherwise you run the risk of blood clots, et cetera. So, again, going back to this, you would get a DEXA scan in 2 years. If you're losing over 2% per year, you want to get some medication. And they also have what they call standard deviations. If you are less than 1.5, you're considered normal, and that's if you're 1.5 to 2.5, you're considered osteopenic. In other words, the bones are getting a little bit too thin. And if you're over 2.5, you graduated to osteoporosis. Now, the medications that are available tend to be quite effective. Of course, it's very important to make sure that you get your DEXA scan. And then what you do is you get a second DEXA scan. Now, my biggest problem is a lot of times gynecology says, well, we're going to decide if you're menopausal if you don't have a period for a year. So as far as I'm concerned, if you think like that, that means you're going to have a patient losing bone for a year because they're osteoporotic, and you're waiting to make sure that you know for sure no period in a year they're menopausal. So, but again, if you become menopausal, and that you can find that out by getting an FSH lab test, and if it's over 35, you're generally considered osteoporotic. You're considered menopausal, and therefore you would put a time one there. You'd repeat your DEXA scan in 2 years. When you repeat the DEXA scan in 2 years, if your bone loss is over 2% per year, you should be treated because you're going to end up becoming a pretzel. Now, of course, that's an exaggeration by myself, but you don't want to lose more than 2% of your bone mass per year. It can be familial. You want to go back and check with mom. Did she get that Dowager's hump with the hump? If she did, time to get treated. So, again, the insurance company will agree with you if you lose 2% per year of your bone mass. That means you have to go to the same place to get your DEXA scan, or at least get, there's three different makers of DEXA scans, and you want to make sure you stick with the same one. So the radiologist has to give you a report, bone mass loss per year. And if so, you want to talk with your gynecologist. Should I be on postmenopausal estrogens? Or your family doctor, should I be on Fosamax, Actonel? Fosamax is once a week. Actonel can be once a week or it could be once a month. I've seen great results with Actonel once a month, and the compliance is great. Yes, the medication they give you is a soap, believe it or not, used as a toothpaste in different countries across the world, but they work tremendously. They basically can reverse it. The other thing they do is if you have a disc, it keeps the outside of the disc up so you don't lose any height. So nobody wants to lose their height because that means they've got significant compression. Now, if you get a little bit worse, the doctors will offer you sometimes Prolia, which is an injection every 6 months. It's now approved for ad infinitum. Used to be only for 2 years. I can say this, when I worked in the hospital, we would get traffic accident. People would come in with significant fractures or repetitive fractures. We put them on Prolia, and for the next 2 years, they were solid. They couldn't believe they didn't come to the hospital anymore. A great drug that's an anabolic. It builds things up. And finally, if you're minus a 2.5, then you're real McCoy, and you're capable for some of the anabolics. Forteo is the one that was put on the market over 10 years. It builds bone nicely, decreases fractures, very nice. There's an Evenity drug now that's once a year. You take it once. It's got a different modus operandi. It basically stops the bone from deteriorating, and it also tends to grow the bone. That's why it's called an anabolic. There's also Tumala. So there's different options you can take to discuss with your doctor if you're losing over 2% of your bone mass per year. Very, very important. I recommend you try and get your serum calcium level because if you have an anabolic that's trying to build bone and you don't have enough calcium, you're gonna slow down the process. So we recommend enough vitamin D3. Remember, D2 is the old stuff. It doesn't absorb as well. You want to go with D3 and titrated dose, no lower than 2,000 international units a day to 5,000. Make sure your doctor titrates up your calcium to 9.6, which is the mean, so that you can take those drugs that they're trying to build bone, fix up that spine, fix up that hip, and then use those medications which will jam the calcium into the bone, make it better bone, and make sure that you stay tall, strong, and without pain for a long time. Osteoporosis can also be treated with IV reclass. The rheumatologists are very strong in this category. They'll give IV reclass, which is an infusion that's quite strong, lasts once a year, as opposed to the take a pill every week. And basically, you want to definitely walk. You want to make sure that you stay exercised. If your osteoporosis is severe, You can also consider estrogens, which we usually naturally use, but the Women's Health Initiative came out a few years ago and indicated that estrogen had certain negatives. There's a lot of the gals who want to go with the estrogens because of the quality of life. We see different ways of doing bones, too, such as the pellets that are inserted in the buttock can also help for the discogenic disease and hip disease. Try and go a little bit further, I do want to talk about quickly that diabetic neuropathy is a significant problem. We had a specialist on from Cooper recently, and I should say this, that when it comes to neuropathy, there's many modus operandis, and not all of them work well. I'm happy to say that some of the newer modus operandis for diabetic neuropathy have really been significant. There is one that is called Qtenza, Qutenza, where the physician applies 8%, or specialist applies 8% topical capsaicin, which then goes in and causes a significant numbness of the nerve. When it does this, the painful diabetic neuropathy can be abated. It has to be applied. It takes an hour to apply it. It goes and hits nociceptive, i.e. pain nerve fibers, which results in a significant improvement in well-being. Sometimes this diabetic pain can be so severe that you can't feel your feet, and that is very tough. Doctors start with medications called tricyclics, which can be very effective. They move on and hopefully never get to pain medicine, but we have the capsaicin 8%. We also have these nerve stimulators that have been put out that also can reverse the pain substantially. Most people would start out, though, with a tricyclic or SNRI, such as Cymbalta or Effexor. They can also use anti-inflammatories, Voltaren, Motrin, Lidoderm patches. Just make sure that you do your best to stop your cigarette smoking because that can aggravate the situation. So diabetic neuropathy has some new things going. Want to make sure that you know that there's other more aggressive approaches that are available. Some patients have even had the ability to get the feeling back in their feet with some of these more aggressive ways. So you want to talk to your rehabilitation specialist to make sure that if you have it, that diabetic painful neuropathy, that you can move forward and get relief and hopefully feel those feet again. It's about time to take off. Bob Merrill will be here, Dr. Bob Merrill, next week. Inside Medicine is available on the website, www.wwdbam.com. You can hit 120 podcasts. Joe Fallon, over and out. We'll see you next week. Remember, great internist Bob Merrill will be on. See you next week, 10 a.m. to 11. Thank you. Have a great Saturday.